We're speaking with Charles Ramsey. He was police chief in D.C. on 9/11.
Could you tell me where you were 9/11 when you found out, when you heard what was happening or that something was happening that day?
Well, on 9/11, and to go back to that time I served as police chief, I'm an early riser, so I got into the office early, around 6:30 in the morning. So I had already finished one of my morning meetings when my chief of staff came in and said, boss, you need to come in and take a look at this. Something's going on in New York. And so I went in his office. He had the Today Show on, and one of the towers had already been struck and was on fire. And I asked what happened. And at the time, he said, they don't really don't know. They think a small plane had flown into the building. And it was unusual because, I mean, it was a very clear day. It was a beautiful day on that particular day. And as we're watching, we literally saw the second plane hit the second tower. And that's when we knew it was no accident. And I remember at the time thinking, you know, who would fly an empty plane into a building? I couldn't get my head around the fact that someone would be vicious enough to take a plane load of innocent people and fly them into a building, again, loaded with innocent people. In any event, we knew it was no accident. And we immediately activated our command center. And ironically, the first day of operation for the DC Joint Operations Command Center was 9/11/01. We had a brand new center that was being built actually to handle a large protest we were anticipating later that year. So the first day of operation was actually 9/11.
Question, my first question was, where were or what did you do first once you figured this out? So let's move on to the second question. Once you set up that command center, were you able to communicate with others? When did the understanding, the confirmation that this was a terror attack come to you?
Well, it took a little while in terms of actually being able to declare it a terrorist attack, but it was very clear and obvious that that's what was taking place. We did activate our command center, and in DC, that becomes a central point where individuals come from other agencies, including federal agencies. We had a representative from the FBI, Secret Service, ATF, even the Federal Aviation Authority sent someone, and of course the surrounding police departments and other city agencies within DC also sent representatives. So we assembled pretty quickly, and it wasn't long after we actually activated the command center that the Pentagon was struck. And so it was very clear that we had an attack that was underway, and our job then was to be able to do the best we could in terms of respond and be able to protect and save as many lives as possible. We did have some communications issues, primarily because of interoperability issues between radio systems. For example, the police department and our own fire department were on different radio frequencies. And whereas that hadn't been a huge problem in the past, it certainly was a problem on 9/11. As well as trying to speak with other city agencies. So there were a lot of issues, and there was a lot of chaos that in the initial moments following the attacks.
I recall being on the roof of the VOA building, which was about two blocks from Indiana Avenue, from your office, and watching the Pentagon burn from there. I was in the building working on that day, and I recall a similar situation when somebody notified me that something wasn't right. And I recall going outside and seeing all of these black SUVs with blue lights flying around on the streets, and it was clear to me something wasn't right. And I learned later that just across the street from us, the Capitol was supposed to be the fourth location.
Yeah,
and felt very lucky later on that it was not, although grieving for those who did die in Shanksville. So, you know, one of the things, as you mentioned, that there was a bunch of confusion that day. So how did policing in emergencies change after 9/11?
Well, you know, in Washington, D.C., which is a unique agency because, of course, we have the the White House and various other federal buildings located in Washington, D.C. So we were no stranger to actually being a part of security for the president, visiting heads of state and so forth. But even in light of that, it certainly changed post 9/11. There's a unit within the Metropolitan Police Department called the Special Operations Division. That's the unit where you see the motorcycle escorts and vehicle escorts whenever there's a presidential movement and so forth. But it became very apparent to me that we needed to create an actual homeland security capacity within MPD and revamp the Special Operations Division to a large extent, which is what we did. And whereas that consumed a percentage of what we did in the Metropolitan Police Department pre 9/11, it actually was enhanced quite a bit after 9/11 because of the security package that we had to provide to assist the Secret Service in presidential movements, other heads of state, some of whom were very high profile, Prime Minister of the UK, for an example, whenever they visited. We certainly were able to provide the full package, as it's called, to them, as well as what we would do for a presidential or vice presidential movement. So it was a significant ramping up of security in the district. Because remember, immediately after 9/11, we all thought that second shoe was going to drop. There was no question in anyone's mind that Washington, D.C. was a target. And as you mentioned, during the initial chaos that occurred when the attacks were actually taking place, one of the rumors, many rumors, was that it was the United States Capitol was a target. And of course, everyone's pretty certain that Flight 93, that those passengers heroically were able to take down, was actually targeting the U.S. Capitol. So the threats were very, very real.
Chief, today, moving forward, you know, a lot of things have changed. A lot of things have remained the same. A lot of things have changed and then gone back to the same, i.e. today, I don't think 20 years ago, or maybe later in the year, in 2001, after the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan, I don't think anybody ever thought that the Taliban would be running that country again. And I don't think anybody thought that there could possibly be a resurgence of an organization like Al-Qaeda through Afghanistan again, because of everything that was done to make sure that didn't happen. But time has a funny way of doing things its own way. So I'm interested in hearing from you today as we move forward. What do you think is important and necessary to remember from 9/11, from what was achieved after 9/11, and from where we are today in order to move forward and keep the nation, certainly the nation's capital, but the entire country safe?
You know, people have short memories, unfortunately. And I recall in the early days after 9/11, we had the color-coded system that the Department of Homeland Security came up with, whether it was, you know, yellow, red, or whatever the colors were at the time. And we were kind of like going from high alert down to a lower alert back and forth. And people were really, you know, pretty much in tune with the threat for foreign terrorists to once again attack us in our homeland. But over time, when that didn't happen, you know, things started to relax a bit. And that's unfortunate. And the other thing that I think it's important to mention is that, you know, in 2001 and the years following, I mean, we wouldn't have thought that the largest threat would have been within our own country as opposed to a foreign threat from outside our country. So there's been an awful lot of changes that have taken place. People have become over time less vigilant than they were before. And I never personally would have imagined after the Afghanistan invasion and after our troops did so well in being able to certainly neutralize the threat from Al-Qaeda, that once again, in 2021, 20 years later, we'd be faced with the same threat, if not perhaps even a greater threat, as we begin to remove our troops from Afghanistan. But again, you know, time moves on, things change, but threats never really go away. They just move around a bit. And this happened to be one that cycled right back in the same place where it all started.
All right. Is there anything you want to add that you think is important on this topic before we go?
Well, I think one of the benefits that actually came as a result of, you know, what happened in 9/11 and knowing that, you know, attacks like that could happen in our own homeland, the cooperation between local, state, and federal agencies was greatly enhanced. There's no question about that. When I took over the Metropolitan Police Department in 1998, I did fill out a form to get a security clearance. I didn't think much of it because I wasn't really concerned. I had a great relationship with the head of the FBI in Washington. If there was something I needed to know, I had no concerns that I wouldn't be informed. But nothing had happened. And I didn't get a security clearance. I didn't have a top secret or even a secret clearance. I think it was a day or two after 9/11, my clearance did come through. And so the communication between federal agencies with their state and local partners was greatly enhanced as a result of that. And that continues today. So that was one of the positive things that came from that, is the fact that all of our agencies recognize that we have to really rely on one another, whether you're in Washington or New York or another city. That has changed and changed significantly since 9/11. There were a lot of lessons learned. Hopefully we never have to go through that again, but we do have new threats that are with us today. And again, those threats are within, not from outside, they're from within. And now we have to be prepared to deal with that new threat and be able to once again come together to protect our communities and protect our country.
Well, Chief Ramsey, it's been a pleasure. Haven't spoken to you in a number of years, at least a dozen or so, but it's a pleasure to talk to you, and I appreciate your wisdom. I appreciate your memories and your ability to essentially boil down what's real and what's needed and share it with us today. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Our next guest is Ed Plauger, retired fire chief who was at the Pentagon on 9/11.
Ed Plauger. I'm a retired fire chief. I retired from the Fairfax County Fire Department after 24 years as a deputy fire chief. And then in December of 93, I was appointed as the fire chief of Arlington County, Virginia, and currently retired from that as well.
All right. Let me just go back to September 11th, 2001. Where were you when the attack happened, when you learned of it?
Yeah, as has been very well documented with the events of that day, I was actually at a credit union in Fairfax because my wife had thought I was working way too much and wanted to spend more time away with the family. And had just sat down with a clerk at the credit union, one of the rare days where I didn't have a stack full of meetings. And the clerk came back with a set of papers and said that they had the television on in the back room, that something was going on at the World Trade Center. And she forgot something, went back, and then she came back again. And she said, there's also something going on at the Pentagon. And I immediately left and drove down Interstate 66, and took me about 20 minutes to pull into the parking lot at the Pentagon.
What did you think when you saw what you saw? What did you see and what did you think?
Well, I knew because of the column of thick black smoke that I saw as I turned onto Route 110 off of 66, the direct access to the Pentagon, that we were in for a very, very difficult situation. 2 weeks prior, to the incident on 9/11, we had had a second alarm fire at the Pentagon. We normally go to the Pentagon on an emergency incident about once a day. It's the world's largest office complex, 6.6 million square feet, 17 and a half miles of interior corridors. 24,000 people work, both civilian and military personnel work at the Pentagon. So we're very familiar with the complex. We have an agreement with the complex, the reservation, the Pentagon reservation, where in the event of a disaster, the Arlington County Fire Department is the lead agency in cooperation with our federal partners. So it was knowing the facility, knowing the complex, knowing the scope of the disaster that we were in for the long haul.
You were off work, and just wondering what your first official action was once you reassumed your duty as fire chief.
Well, when I arrived, I immediately went to the command post and met with the assistant chief, assistant fire chief, Jim Schwartz, the operations chief, and asked some very technical questions about particularly EMS capacity. Were we keeping up with the EMS workload? Did we have enough units? The situation was obviously very dynamic at the time. In the answers to the questions, the incident, I felt, needed an overarching level of command, chose to leave him in charge of the incident command, the immediate firefighting rescue operation. I then went over and asked the Park Police helicopter that was there if they were on a medevac unit or on a medevac call, and they said no, they were not. So I asked them if they would give me a view of the complex, 360 view of the complex, which they did. And I was able to determine that the incident was separated from the rest of the complex by what is called the Ring Road, which is a road that goes around inside the complex, the third ring in, and then went back and immediately reported to the command post, which had been moved under the overpass at 395 because of the threat of a possible second aircraft heading towards the DC area.
Interoperability was a gigantic problem that day. How did it impact you?
Well, the ability to get reports from the units that were there was next to impossible. So fire operations are conducted with a regular set of reports back to the command post, and the ability to then orchestrate the effectiveness of the units is hampered when you don't have effective communications. And things like water supply, we were setting up an alternative water supply to the incident. And it just makes life truly, truly difficult when you don't have the communications that you're used to having on a regular basis. We had units from all over the Washington metropolitan area at the incident. And again, interoperability was a huge issue. We actually used some runners to get information as to the status of the various units. Again, I can't stress how important communications is.
Moving forward, how did fire and EMS tactics and work change as a result of the experiences that you all witnessed and engaged and were subject to on 9/11?
Well, the ability to manage complex incidents has continued to increase over time. And I think that we use the lessons learned from the Pentagon to enhance our relationships with our partners. Even though we had diligently worked in the 4 years prior to 9/11 to build a robust capacity for the National Capital Region for a terrorist attack, we were focused primarily on a chemical attack similar to the incident that occurred in the subway system in Tokyo. And we, with our federal partners, had built a specialized response team made up of members of organizations throughout the Washington metropolitan area, including private sector, EMS personnel, doctors, that sort of thing. We had a cache of specialized medical supplies to respond to a chemical terrorist attack. Well, we realized that our scope was too narrow, and the nation learned that we needed to broaden our response capabilities. And we're continuing to learn that today as we see the wildfires in the West, as we see the flooding that occurs in Tennessee and the other parts of the United States. We're continuing to see that the things that harm us take a coordinated, complex response by everybody. And we're talking about bringing into the envelope a complete set of array of individuals that are pre-positioned, allow us to respond in an effective fashion, which takes command, control, coordination. We've learned a lot about incident command. We've learned how to broaden it, how to teach it nationally. It's a great learning tool, but one we wish we never had to learn.
You started talking a little bit about where we are now and where we're going from here. I'm just wondering if you could just give me your view of what was learned on that day, how things changed, and how that will essentially prepare us for, say, the next 20 years. As I mentioned to Chief Ramsey when I was speaking to him, I've been to Afghanistan 3 times, embedded with the military, and I have seen firsthand what the landscape there is like and what the terror problem is there. And 20 years ago, I just never imagined that we would be faced with what we're faced there now with the Taliban returning to power. I'm not asking you that particular question, but I just wanted to put it into context. There are organizations and threats that have evolved and that once were defeated and once were essentially no longer a threat, but some of them have arisen to become threats again. One of them is Al-Qaeda. And when they rise, they don't just rise in the form that they were before. They bring with them incredible know-how. They study just like good people do, people who are focused on good things. They go to school to figure out how to do what they want to do more effectively. So I'm just wondering what your experience is, what was learned on 9/11, what we learned since then, what your view is on the application of all of that towards a resilient much more secure future, and certainly the ability for fire and EMS services to do what they need to do.
Well, first off, we spent, I should say, the Arlington County and the Department of Justice spent a great deal of money to learn from the incident at the Pentagon. We did an after-action report that had over 200 recommendations for both fire, EMS, law enforcement, and emergency management. One of the things that we continued to focus on was relationship building prior to the incident and the ability to deal with complex incidents, complex situations, with a level-headed, pre-thought-out set of dynamics And it's a great opportunity. The 20th anniversary is a great opportunity to go back and re-review and find out exactly where we are on those recommendations, and then also modernize them, bring them up to date. And our world has vastly changed with the advent of the cellular technology and all of the advancements that we have from the communications resources that we now have, including the internet, prolific use of the internet and such. But we have a civilian community that has learned to, if you see something, say something. We have a great relationship with, then I'm talking about the Fire EMS organization. We have a great relationship with our communities that we serve. And we need to continue to foster and develop that in such a fashion that it's part and parcel to everything that we do. And that's our relationship building with our community. How do we overcome? I think the genesis of your question was, how do we overcome the threats that exist today? We continue to work through and build our systems robust enough, whether that's their natural, man-made, or a terrorist purposeful attack. We develop a set of response systems that are second to none in the world, and we have that capacity if we can get everybody singing and moving in the same direction, singing on the same song and moving in the same direction. So we need to effectively orchestrate our communities into a cohesive, modern element. I continue to think about one little teeny element that is surprising. The sudden onset of a heart attack occurs in America almost every day, right? That does occur every day. The response to that is a local situation that envelops a series of great responses. In other words, not only does the EMS providers, but the individual who witnesses the attack, and if they take the immediate action, and if they know CPR, and if they can perform effective CPR, the outcome is dramatically changed. So the same thing occurs in a threatened environment. If you see something and say something, and if you know how to properly react, you can effectively alter the outcome. So it's a partnership. It's a partnership in society. We need to manage our threats, both natural and man-made. And I think we will. I think we will continue to learn. We'll continue to evolve in a society that's free and open. With our beliefs that there is good out there.
Excellent. Chief, thank you so much. Just one final thing. Is there anything you'd like to add that I haven't asked you about that you think is important?
Well, building relationships is key. Both federal, state, and local relationships need to occur prior to an incident. So train together, work together. I know as our preparedness for a terrorist attack in the Washington area, the National Capital area, we had actually taken in March of 2001. Remember now, this is months before the attack on 9/11. We had taken all the key leadership from the response units, fire, EMS, and police agencies, to the National Fire Academy, which is close in Emmitsburg, Maryland. And we had learned together as a cohesive unit, we had learned together the new incident command system developed from the attack in Oklahoma City that was developed jointly between the National Fire Academy and the FBI. We were teaching that locally as a cohesive response element, And on 9/11, that event occurred, and we worked as a cohesive unit. We had drilled mightily with the personnel from the Pentagon. We had actually conducted drills on the reservation at the Pentagon prior to 9/11. So it can happen. We need to learn the lessons of that. We need to continue to reinforce that. So thank you for the opportunity to bring that up.
Chief Plauger, thank you so much. Thank you for what you did that day, what you did before that, which prepared you for that day, and everything you've done since then to help this nation prepare for what may be next. And thank you for those very apropos words of wisdom for the future. Thank you.
Thank you for bringing up the issue.
Let's throw it back over to Chief Ramsey for any final thoughts.
I listened to Ed, and even in my comments, we were talking about interoperability issues, which were actually terrible on 9/11. And JJ asked the question, after, 20 years later, there's, some of the issues that still exist. Well, interoperability continues to be an issue, only it's not like it was on 9/11. There have been a lot of progress that's been made in this area. Since 9/11, Congress passed legislation creating FirstNet, which is a public safety network that eliminated an awful lot of the issues and the problems. And certainly, within FirstNet, there is interoperability. The problem is that's not the only public safety network that's out there. Verizon has one, T-Mobile has one, and the interoperability issue now is between those networks. So within the network, there is full interoperability, whether you're on FirstNet, whether you're on Verizon, whether you're on T-Mobile. But if agencies are on different networks, in other words, I'm on the Verizon network, you are on the FirstNet or T-Mobile, our ability to be able to have that same level of interoperability between those networks isn't there right now. And that's something that's still out there. It may take Congress actually to step in and make sure that during an emergency, all these networks, regardless of which one you're on, you have full interoperability, full data, voice, whatever method that's being used to communicate, those barriers are removed. And I feel compelled to mention that because that still remains an outstanding issue. But I don't want to give the impression that no change has been made and that there has not been progress. There has been progress. The problem now is between the networks and full interoperability between networks. And so I just wanted to throw that out there because that's still an outstanding issue as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, Chuck, I'll reinforce that. I call that myself, I call that operability. Because within a network, you are interoperable. But when you go across networks, then you need to be operable. In other words, you need to play on the same playing field.
Right.
So I think we need to truly focus on not only interoperability, but operability. Which is how do we orchestrate all the units? How do we get them working on the same page? How do we get them in an effective, which is a whole set of other things, including jargon, including relationship building prior to the incident, understanding that every organization has different titles and the titles mean different things. And so being able to operate effectively requires operability, and communications requires interoperability.
I agree with that wholeheartedly, and I think that's a good way of framing it. Just to give you an example, I've got a Android phone, my service provider is AT&T. Ed is on an iPhone. Let's say his service provider is Verizon. I can pick up my phone and call Ed, and I don't get a message saying, this call can't be completed because we're on different, we're using different providers, or I have an Android, he's got an iPhone. I mean, it's seamless. It just goes through. And that's what we need in public safety. It shouldn't matter which network you happen to be on. You should have a right to choose whatever network. They're all good networks. There's no question about that. But in a crisis, we don't need to have this kind of division that we currently see, that currently exists. It needs to be seamless. And that way we can maximize our ability to respond effectively, whether we're fighting a wildfire, whether we're fighting flooding, whether we're dealing with a terrorist attack, whatever it is, our responsibilities are to protect the public and save as many lives as possible, respond as effectively as we can. And we need to have effective communications and seamless communications in order to be able to do that.
Thank you, Chief Ramsey. Thank you, Chief Plauger, both of you, for your perspectives.